Hello and welcome to a very special Amazing Spider-Man edition of the Empire Podcast. I'm Chris Hewitt and I'm joined by James Dyer, Helen O'Hara and Nick Desimlian. And we'll be discussing the film in great spoiler-filled depth, so, and I can't stress this enough, don't listen to this podcast until you've seen The Amazing Spider-Man. Unless, of course, you're just plain weird and love spoilers. Still with us? Excellent. But before we crack on with what we think, let's get the thoughts of the Amazing Spider-Man producers Avi Arad and Matt Tolmach, the men behind the reboot. They came into the pod booth recently for a general discussion about the film, which, in case you didn't know, retells the origin of Marvel's friendly neighbourhood web-slinging wall crawler, with Andrew Garfield as Peter Parker, Emma Stone as Gwen Stacy, and Reese Evans as the Lizard. And then, after that general discussion, we went into spoiler overdrive. Here's what they had to say, and they were talking to me and James. How are you, gents?
We are good. We're happy to be here.
Great. The latest leg of your world tour. Where have you been so far?
We started in Tokyo,
mm-hmm. and Seoul, Korea,
and Moscow,
and Moscow, and
then right
London.
Here to London, and then tonight after the premiere, we go to Paris, and then Berlin,
mm-hmm. and then Madrid,
and Roma, and then back to New York.
And then back to LA.
And then we lie down for a while. We just lie down at Avi's house in Malibu.
Okay. So you're not going straight into the sequel then?
Oh, we're in it.
The writers
are doing their bit, so we get to lie down for 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what's the feeling like for you guys at the moment? Are you nervous because your baby is just about to go out into this world? And are you worried about receptions? Are you confident that people are going to love this thing?
You know what? I should be nervous, probably being stupid, not being nervous, but we love this movie, and we thought about it for a long time. It's not like something new. We were working on it before we abandoned Number 4. And once the casting came together and the CGI came together and the amazing chemistry between Andrew and Emma, and the rest of the cast that is exemplary. I don't know. We
had this great moment when we finally got to see the movie at IMAX, in 3D at IMAX. And I mean, obviously, Avi and I have been there involved in every moment of this thing, and we knew what we were doing. But finally, you see it, and it was mind blowing. And I remember, we walked up to Mark Webb and sort of looked at him like, "You saw this. This is what you were imagining." And it's. I think it probably, in the movie business, it works one of several ways. You have an idea and a vision for something, and sometimes it doesn't live up to that. Sometimes maybe it does, and then sometimes it exceeds it in a way that is just what movie magic is.
And there is another meter to it.
Yeah.
When you see first, we live by the monitor, so you see every shot as it unfolds. And for us, we watch it on the 3D monitors.
Hmm.
And then you look at dailies, and then you look at cuts, and then early cut and later cut. So we see the movie
over and over,
endlessly,
and in unfinished
and
terms
unfinished
as well.
Unfinished terms.
Well, the visual effects.
But some, and there are days that we do nothing but watch visual effects, and there are some days that we're just listening to score, and in a way, for us, the mark of a movie that we are starting to feel good about is that we still enjoy. There are certain parts that we'll always laugh at, and there are certain parts that we'll always feel like provocative.
Mm-hmm.
We are interested in a movie.
Mm.
And that's kind of, when you are into something for 2 years, that's a good sign when you want to see it again. And that day in IMAX was like,
oh, we couldn't believe it. I mean, it was like, really? Because the part of you, and this is what I think you want to have happen in that moment, you want to be just a guy going to the movies.
Yeah.
And to be able to separate yourself from everything you've been through for the last 2 years. And we did. I mean, we all looked at you, we were giddy, just like kids who'd gone to see Spider-Man. And and then the other thing that's happening right now, it's you're sort of your baby's going out into the world, and the best thing, like obviously got kids, and I have a son, and it's cool when people like your kids, you know. It's really nice when they're like, I love your son. Yeah. People are really responding to this movie.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a whole other layer. Because sure, we love it, but to see people react to it as strongly as they have and to be as passionate and outspoken is, yeah, it's what you dream for.
It was especially fun to come from behind.
Yeah.
There's no question that when you have a trilogy by Sam Raimi, incredibly well done trilogy, and a beloved director, and obviously a beloved character, an actor, and it left an impact. It did well enough to have really impacted our world. And the first question from everybody on the boards, as you remember, well, too early, too late, why now, why tomorrow, you know, all this nonsense. And which is, it's never about time, it's about content. You know, it's like no one asked Renoir why he made a second painting. Like, already you just finished one. It's not about the timeline.
Did you just make that up?
Yeah.
That was good.
It's the story has to hold. And once we felt that we still knew, you can write down the questions you will get. And our fan base, especially sitting in Empire, you will relate to that. And I dealt with it all my life in Marvel. They love the fact that we are doing something new.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they're so precious about the property, about the Spider-Man, that there is almost like, you know, if someone put a cigarette to the palm of your hand and threaten you, I'm going to do this, it's easier to just grab it, you know, crush the cigarette so it burns one time. It's not the anticipation, because that's what kills you.
Yeah.
So once people started seeing materials that made them comfortable, it became something we could take.
Yeah.
Before, we couldn't combat it. I mean, the materials are not ready.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You know, you read every day what, you know, people's ideas about what they think you're doing. And you can't say anything, and you know, you just have to keep your head down and make the best version of the movie, you know, that you think you can make.
Yeah.
And you know, at the end of the day, you're incredibly glad people care that much.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think the flip side is you work on a movie where nobody gives a, I don't know what the audience is for your radio show, but
you can say fuck. It's fine.
I was only going to go for shit. Nobody gives a fucking shit. But you know, that's a place you don't want to live.
Yeah.
And so this is the other thing, which is everybody gives a huge shit. But cool, because you know, we think we have.
But it strikes me with this one that you do have a secret weapon, kind of in the form of Andrew Garfield, who to my mind, I think, embodied Peter Parker in a way that, you know, no disrespect to Tobey Maguire, but no one has ever really done before.
Yeah.
I mean, at what stage did you realize that? I mean, was it the casting stage when you made that decision? Because that's not something you would have gone into lightly.
Casting was I mean, we always say it was the most scariest moment,
exactly.
If there was one, because you know, we had a great story to tell, and we had a director we loved, and we feel pretty good about ourselves, and the studio's behind us, and you know, you have all the pieces in place. Who's Peter Parker? You know, that's the center of the whole thing of the movie. And if you didn't find that, what are you going to do? And, you know, there was this moment where we were really lucky. I mean, it's not a surprise that there are a lot of really talented actors who would have loved to have played this part. And so there, you know, I was at the studio at the time, but there were, a zillion really talented people auditioning for the role. But it comes down to that moment where you look at somebody's audition, and in this case Andrew, he was Peter Parker. I mean, he just embodied him, you know, with his lanky, long, you know, body, his physique, and his wry wit, and his intensity, his intelligence, and you know,
and
just
charm,
incredibly charming.
Plus, he has amazing hair.
he has the best hair in the world. I look at it as someone who has, I suffer from bad hair. You guys have no hair. Yeah. I just suffer from dry head. And I see Garfield every day. It's like this, it's all like fluffy and layered. It's fantastic.
Like a L'Oreal advert. Yeah.
Well, okay, so you figured it out. It was the hair.
And we found a guy that had the physicality to support one of the bylaws were to make a movie that is more realistic and more visceral. Mm. Like you wanted to feel the action. Yeah. This action is hard to do. And he is just a natural born athlete and committed himself to it. I think probably the thing that hit me most about Garfield is his commitment for his age.
Yeah.
Working with the stunt guys on nights off. Like he'll be off, they will on. He was there with them to make sure that the body language and so on is the same. So you had incredible discipline actor who really cared about every word he's saying and why he's saying it and knowing Spider-Man. So when it all came together, again, it was very hard to introduce to the world and the same reaction you have. They don't know how to react.
They don't know what to think.
Because if you think, you close your eyes and you think of Spider-Man that you know from the movies, you have an image, and the image is Toby.
Yeah.
And you, to transcend that, something has to come in and do such a different job and such a good job that all of a sudden you say, yeah, that's Peter Parker. And no need for comparisons because this is a different movie now.
And I think that's a really important point. There is no need for comparison. And Toby was spectacular and for a lot of people, you know, very iconic in that role. This is a completely different interpretation of that character.
So this is the ultimate Spider-Man to that sensational Spider-Man or something along those lines.
It's actually what sets up apart is the origin.
Yeah.
Because I think our origin, in all fairness, in this movie is more important to children and adults, by the way. Mm. The fact that our lives are basically carved when we are very young. Especially, they tell you your parents are gone. They didn't come back. You know nothing about it. You'll always live in this dichotomy of, why did they leave me? It's like children of divorce. You know, it's so known when they start crying and saying, I'll be good. They think they had something to do with it, and they don't. And here's a kid who, this shroud of secrecy makes him think that his parents were not good people.
And because of it, he also doesn't know
who he is.
That's
a great origin for a child that becomes an only child. Mm. In a way, he's adopted, which is, again, there's crowds of children around the world that suffer from the same question. Who am I? Why I don't have what my friends have a normal life. You go to school on the first day, teachers do this thing. So what's your father do? Well, I don't have a father.
Yeah.
And boom, all of a sudden, the whole class, I don't have a father. I mean, and that was such a great thing to do because Peter Parker, for us, has to speak for all of them and for all of us.
Mm.
So it was like when Andrew came into it with these really warm eyes. You know, Andrew has an emotional vulnerability and tremendous strength at the same time. And that's a new kind of hero. That's really a new kind of
incredible,
guy.
Incredible compassion.
Mm.
But, you know, the thing, what Avi's talking about, when you make a decision to focus on this hugely seminal event that happens to this little boy, which is that his parents leave for whatever reason, good, bad, just, he doesn't know.
Yeah.
And the legacy of that is incredibly powerful, and it's the most defining thing. He's a boy on a quest, not only to figure out what happened, but as a result, who am I? You know, and where do I fit in? And so what happened with our movie very organically is it became this kind of quest.
Yeah.
And Peter is at the heart of everything that happens in the movie.
Absolutely.
Because he's chasing this question.
Well, it could almost be called The Amazing Peter Parker because the focus seems to be much more on him than it is on Spider-Man. And it's about him becoming Spider-Man, obviously.
We played with that, by the way.
We did.
We actually played with The Amazing, the story of Peter Parker.
As a subtitle.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
We did. It just was a lot of words.
Big posters.
But conceptually, it was the right thing. It's a movie about secrets. It's a movie about everybody's missing something. Reese is missing an arm. He's missing parents. She's missing something, and she falls in love with him, and so on.
And everybody's trying to get whole. Mm. That's the whole thing. It's what price
life,
you're willing to
which
pay.
Which is what we are all trying to do.
That's
get
right.
It all. So
absolutely. Andrew, as we all know, is a massive Spider-Man fan. He grew up idolizing this character and idolizing Peter Parker. He's admitted in interviews that pressure got to him at times, and he had to see therapists and whatnot to deal with the pressure of bringing this beloved character to life. How did that impact on you guys? I mean, and how obviously you were there to support him through these difficult times as he was making the film.
It didn't impact us in any way other than it gave him. He took everything incredibly seriously. I mean, talk about with great power. You know, this was a kid, or he's not a kid anymore, but this is a guy who grew up. I mean, he sent us a picture of himself when he was 3 years old in a Spider-Man outfit.
I'd love to see that picture.
Which I'm sure he'll show you. Maybe not. But
doubt it somehow.
But he did, you know, he stood up at Comic-Con, you know, and now it's a well-known story. If you back up from Comic-Con, the night before Comic-Con, we had all gotten together to prepare, you know, the road show that we were going to do and talk about what we were showing, and we were with him. And it was Avi and me and Andrew, and he said to us, "Do you guys mind if I read you something I wrote?" We said, "Sure, you know, whatever." You know, he said, "Because I'm thinking maybe I'll, if you like it, you know." And he read this thing, which was a letter to the fans explaining his love of the character. And what an incredible honor and responsibility it was to bring that character to life. That was so genuine and honest. And, you know, obviously he then read it, and I think people really responded.
Yeah.
But it was incredibly important for him to tell people that he took this very seriously. And the same was true when we were shooting, that he made very serious decisions about the character based on a love of that character. And things, obviously he interpreted it, but things that were true to Peter Parker meant a lot to him. And he's just an unbelievable professional. And you know, sometimes in life you have a job that also coincides with a great passion, you know, and that's what this was for him. So it was actually very cool to be part of. In that way.
Fantastic. The film begins and ends with Peter in high school, around about 17 years old, something like that. Andrew is now 28. He's about to be 29, I think. Are you worried in case he ages really badly over the next couple of years, just in case he has some road miles, so to speak?
Well, on his face? We provided for it. At the end of the night after the premiere, Andrew is going to go into a cryogenic club.
Yeah, and age backwards, actually.
And age backwards. Yeah. And we are going to release him for the sequel.
Okay, yeah, good.
And then we are going to put him back in ice.
Did you guys see Benjamin Button?
Yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
It's true. It's a true story.
The Curious Case of Andrew Garfield.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you could clone him. I know Spider-Man and clones don't necessarily work, but you could go down that road.
Not as long as I'm alive.
That's
not
right.
Cloning.
That's right.
I remember coming into Marvel to the cloning saga. Oh, man.
Do you remember somebody pitched us that idea?
Yes. Yeah.
So, and you had them burned.
Actually,
I've never seen Avi react so viscerally in a room. Usually quite polite. This did not go well for the writer. And he was so excited. He thought like he was like, this is cool.
You can tell he didn't do his homework. All he had to do is go online and see the clone stories that almost closed down Marvel.
That's right.
It was...
And then pitch that story.
Oh, Ben Reilly shall have his day. Right. He shall happen. Right, so we just want to talk about some second, third act stuff now for this separate podcast. So one thing that hangs over the movie is Oscorp and Norman Osborn, who is frequently referred to, but as far as we know, never seen. Can you talk about that decision and to, I guess, exclude Norman, first of all?
Well, Oscorp for us, in Spider-Man, New York City is a character. It's part of the Spider-Man story. Daily Bugle is the news service that serves New York City within the universe of Spider-Man. Oscorp is the Dark Tower. It's the Vader of industry, if you will.
Yeah.
In which things happening for good and bad of humanity But they are usually taking things to a level that may be illegal, may be designed for mass destruction, and so on and so forth. At the end of, so we put in this tower that looks amazing in the movie, and actually if it was ready on time, we met with Kevin and we were going to put it into his New York and we were going to put Stark Tower into our New York.
Oh really, you had that conversation?
Yeah. Oh, we had a whole meeting about it.
Yeah, it's a whole meeting. And we loved the idea.
The effects weren't ready.
It just, we couldn't, in the future, hopefully we'll be able to get it through because it's fun. So Norman for us in this movie wasn't an important face. Mm-hmm. Okay, it was more a symbolic idea of the world of science. It's a place where his father worked. It's a place that Connors worked, and most important is a place that Peter aspired to be in. Mm-hmm. One, because his father was there too. It stands for the ultimate advancement of science and biotechnology and so on. So the threat of Norman at the top, that's what the comics are about. You can read the whole comic book and you have a mention of something that may not appear for two more issues.
Yeah.
But the threat of Norman there, especially when you have the new girl, you have Gwen Stacy, you want a hint, you know, it's like a painting. You just put a little Norman somewhere.
Yes.
Because, you know, the truth is if you delve a lot further, and you've seen the movie now, we had a lot of story to tell within this movie. And Dr. Connors is a very rich character. And that's where we wanted to spend time, on that relationship between Peter and Dr. Connors and the lizard. And so, you know, if you begin to then venture into Norman and Oscorp in this movie, you have a finite amount of screen time.
Yeah.
So, as Avi said, he hangs over this building and the lives of these people. And, you know, we're going to make more movies.
Absolutely. But there are some fascinating ideas contained within that, because it's stated very clearly a couple of times that Norman Osborn, difficult to say, is dying. And his origin would then seem to be linked in some way with the lizards. And obviously Spider-Man is then responsible for, or Peter is responsible for, not only the lizard's origin, but down the line, we would assume, the Green Goblins. Can you talk about that?
Well, if you look at Norman affliction, if you will, cross-species genetics, or any kind of that science, is exactly what he needs to survive. Mm. So obviously he will support this kind of science to the nth degree, and the nth degree is, of course, where is happening in laboratories around the world, and cloning and stem cell that is being used to create life forms that we really don't know what to do with them if we create them. So it all made sense that at the top of the building there is a guy that has a huge personal stake, and then you have Connors, who has a huge personal stake in succeeding, and then you have the man who's supposed to be carrying the clue for it, who vanished,
who's disappeared,
and it happened to be Peter's dad.
Yeah.
And this line in the movie when he says, "It's something my father was working on, and now I know why he wanted it to be kept a secret."
Yeah.
There's a weird sense in which
science doesn't work like that. They just go for it.
Yeah.
They're all sort of Norman's lab rats.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
There's something that Norman needs, and everybody here also has their own needs, and Peter becomes the little mouse in the, you know, and the metaphor is breaking down on me, but he's the puppeteer, Norman, and that's something we're going to get to.
You say Norman Osborn, people think Green Goblin, but the interesting thing, certainly from reading the Dark Reign comics a few years ago, is that Norman Osborn, just as a personality, is actually a very powerful villain character. I mean, is that something you'd want to explore before or even instead of tackling the Green Goblin? I'm not holding you to this, but
listen, the Goblin is excuse me, the Goblin can be something that happens for a very short period of time, or the Goblin can become a whole story. The real story is Norman. And I think this movie showed beyond the shadow of a doubt that Peter Parker is the most interesting study here. The fact that he becomes Spider-Man and so on, it's great, and it's wish fulfillment, and it's the metaphor and all this stuff. But Peter works so well. And Norman needs to work really, really well and be the kind of classical Marvel sympathetic villain who carries something very personal as a reason to do what he's doing. Mm. And the fact that he's going to fly through the air and fly and fight Peter, eventually it will be inevitable. But that's not his main story.
And he's also, he like Connors, and this is important, is connected to Peter Parker. You know, Norman is connected to Peter Parker. Mm. And you get hints of that in the movie, obviously, his relationship to Peter's father, his relationship to Doc Connors. So Norman Osborn, the man, is critically important to where this story is going.
It's all about secrets.
Yeah.
Norman has a secret. Connors has a secret. Mm. Peter's father had a secret. Now Peter has a secret. When Peter and Connors connect, he's still keeping a secret. So I have this thing here, and why don't we try it?
Yeah.
But he never really say up front to him, this is where I got it.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely.
So it's all about secrets, and all these people contain amazing powers. Peter is the ultimate specimen. You know, he's okay. He seems like, wow, it worked on him. So all these little hints that you see throughout the movie are saying, so if it worked on Peter, oh boy, this kid is not going to have a moment of peace.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thing to look at.
Mm. I think in the end, you know, like we said, Norman is a really important character. And as Avi said, I mean, there's a certain inevitability to someday, you know, seeing the Green Goblin. Mm. What we always have done and will do is, you know, what serves the story best, you know, and again, going back to this quest that Peter is very clearly still on when this movie ends, that's going to lead us to villains. That's the best version of how you figure out who your villain is going to be, is how it serves Peter's story along the way. So when that moment comes,
of course
we're not scared of it.
He never finds the guy that he's ultimately looking for, the guy who kills Uncle Ben. So
Correct.
That's the part of it.
He hasn't yet.
Yes.
Yet, indeed. Well, speaking of secrets, there is a sequence later on in the credits where we see the arrival of someone else. Was that Norman? Can you tell us who that was?
The man in the shadows.
Possibly, yes. He didn't seem... how you'd expect Norman Osborn to be in the way that he presented himself.
Right. Remember what Avi said about secrets? Well, yeah, we have some too.
Okay. It was Thanos.
Yes, it was.
<That's right. laughs> I mean, you get two secrets out of it. Who is this guy?
Yeah.
And what's going to happen to Connors?
Absolutely. And the connection as well to Peter's parents and whatnot.
That's the thing. There's more. There are people watching.
Yeah.
And that you know, there are people watching Peter Parker, and that's that sense of foreboding is kind of cool.
And it's fun to know that they don't have to know who is Peter Parker. Mm. They have to know that there is a specimen out there calling himself Spider-Man that has all these abilities, and if you are in the know, and you want something special, you want this guy.
Yeah.
He contains
that's always
the secret.
A good point to know that Spider-Man is now being watched by very powerful people that are not going to sit on the sideline not figuring out what made this thing so special.
Because there's a suggestion throughout the movie that Peter was prepared, if you will, for this process that he undergoes, that perhaps there's some sort of latent ability in his DNA that was triggered by the spider bite rather than implanted by the spider bite. Can you talk about Matt's expression alone in case we may be onto something?
I love the interpretation.
Can you comment on that? I mean, there's the shot, the close-up of the spider in the glass at the beginning when his father has disappeared.
Well, that was a nice shot.
We're all spoiler friends here.
Is that what that was?
That's what it was.
That web is so tricky.
I think that, again, as much as we can address it is the fact that Peter's father was into spider research. And then let people's imagination do the legwork. And when we read it online, maybe we'll know what to do with it.
Exactly.
We are looking for answers.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Because you're blowing fanboys' minds, because the idea with, I mean, Chris mentioned Thanos. At the end of the Avengers, having Thanos there, it was a... if you know your Marvel, you'll know who this is, and you'll have a big old smile on your face. When we went to see it, someone in front of me went, "Dude, it's Hellboy!" It's not Hellboy.
That's hilarious.
Wrong publisher. Right. But with this, I mean, presumably it was... I mean, you probably get loads of people flicking through their baggage. Who the hell was that?
Yeah.
Was it more just a sense that there's a larger world here? It wasn't about identifying this character. Yes. It was about the big picture.
Yes. Yeah. It's both. I mean, it's really about the larger world and all of that. But, you know... it's one of those things that you're going to look back after the next movie and it will make more sense. Mm. And we're not going to screw that up for you or for us. But it is also about the larger world. And again, that I think just moviegoer sitting in the theater and I feel like my movie's ended and, you know, and the last line, you know, Peter's last line and all that to Gwen. And then there's this whole other thing happening. Mm. And I love that idea that, wait a minute, there's more going on here, and the powers that be are not finished with our boy and with this story, and so it's a tease in a sense, but
nothing
it also
is finished.
Yeah, at all.
The girl is not finished. Aunt May is not finished
at all.
Well, you mentioned different things going on. The beating heart of this story is almost the love story between the two of them, which plays out fantastically because Emma Stone is amazing.
She is that.
On every level. But was there a sense, I mean, was there ever a consideration of cutting just at the smile, you know, that she gives the smile in the classroom? That, to me, felt like almost an idea. I mean, it's great that there's a bit on the end and you see more, but that seemed like a perfect knowing way to end it. Was that ever
on the
cards?
To cut out on the smile?
Yeah, to cut on the smile and just finish.
Frankly, we think that it's a Spider-Man movie. And you need to make sure that you end up on Peter on the fact that he's Spider-Man. And he's going out there for one more swing. It's a wonderful, uplifting thing, because when her father says to him, "I was wrong about you, Peter.
Yeah.
You know, take care of the city."
Yeah.
And he made a tough decision, you know, what do I do with the girl, what do I do with the promise? But at the end, the one thing that he's fulfilling for all of us, and I think people want to see it, I find it very satisfying, is the fact that yes, I am Spider-Man and I own it. Because the way he swings, the way he does it, you see the joy of life in the swing. It's not, he's not worried, he's not depressed. I'm Spider-Man and I'm up there and I'm looking at you. And that's Spider-Man.
The two are, look, we obviously, we saw the movie without that because, you know, it wasn't finished.
So we
know what that looks like. And it's very provocative to go to, you know, black after that. But what Avi says is right, and you have to look at it. There, those two scenes, the scene in the classroom and then Spider-Man taking the final flight, are related. You have to track the emotion of Peter Parker. At the end of the scene in the high school, he sees possibility.
Yeah.
I can have it all. I can do this. Possibly. and so with that optimism, you want to feel him fully realized that, you know, there's hope for love, and I'm going to be this hero, and it's a different, but they're the same. Do you know what I'm saying? They're linked as an idea, and then as fans, what Avi's saying is right. I want to see Spider-Man fly again, you know, over and over and over again. But I want to feel the emotion of that swing. That's the thing. You always want to know what he's feeling when he's swinging, and what he's feeling in that moment is, I think I can hold all these pieces together.
Yeah, because we haven't really seen that in the movie. I mean, when his heroic swing towards Oscorp at the end, he's injured,
right.
He's struggling, but this is the first time we've really seen him fully realized as Spider-Man.
You know, you hear the sirens go by,
yeah,
and the cars go by,
yeah,
and he's Spider-Man. That's his job now.
Yeah,
and this is really, as we said before,
the new sheriff.
That's right. The mantle has been passed from Captain Stacy, and he's the new sheriff in town.
That's right. I just want to talk about process, and obviously Gwen's story is well known to comic book fans and how it ends. I was very intrigued that you didn't end it that way in this film, because I love these guys together, and I'm glad we're going to see them in at least one more movie. Was there ever a point in the development of this film that Gwen's story ended the way it does in the comics?
No. It would have been too fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As you can tell, it took a whole movie to let us all enjoy this new relationship.
Yeah.
To show what a match they are. Because the more you fall in love with them as a couple, the more you want them to be together, the bigger the tragedy and the conflict will be into the future.
Mm.
Because if you introduce her and get rid of her in the first movie,
it feels manufactured.
It feels manufactured. Yeah. And by the way, and there's no rush. The nice thing was this universe, there's no rush. You don't need to close the door on anything.
Mm.
After 50 years of publishing, why? Because if the story is good, you let it breathe. Yeah. No one is going to say, I'm not going to see this movie because... the night Gwen Stacy died, it didn't happen in movie one.
Yeah.
I think if you fell in love with Gwen in this movie, the last thing you want is not to see her again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I felt a palpable sense of relief. I'll be honest.
That's, you know, we love this material.
Yeah.
We love comics. And we try and think the way you would think. At what point the next level may be acceptable?
Mm.
And it better mean something. You don't sacrifice something like that for nothing. It better have some huge emotional implications. And without going into detail, I mean, someone is always responsible, right?
Absolutely.
And that's it.
Okay, fair enough. Just a couple of last questions before we let you guys go. When we spoke for Empire's cover feature, we talked about the proto-goblin. Which is Irfan Khan's character, or less what he was billed as when he was first cast. Did that thread go away in the end, or was there an idea that the proto-goblin didn't quite make the film, or what was the thinking there?
Proto-goblin.
There was a talk about a second bad guy at one point.
So I don't know where the talk came from, not from us.
Yeah.
Okay. We tried multiple villains before, as you know. And it's really hard to service, especially when you go into an origin story. Also, there was no reason to ask Connors. It's a movie about secrets, and Connors holds secrets, and Norman holds secrets. So to bring in an active villain into it...
Yeah.
That doesn't really, that is more of an active, physically active villain than an emotional active villain, would have served the movie poorly.
Yeah.
Because the whole idea behind Connors is, and Peter, that he cannot destroy him. He can't. His wealth of information that forget for a second if he likes him and... He feels fatherly and all this. This is irrelevant. What's relevant is he holds secrets. He holds answers. Yeah. And I don't want to destroy him because I kind of like this guy and I screwed up.
Yeah,
I could have talked to him. He would have had a stubble instead of an arm, but we still could have talked. But I was so anxious to say, thank you for letting me into your life. And let me... give you something now, and look what I did.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was more important than starting to... We had enough...
He was never... I mean, to be honest with you, he was always like an administrator. I mean, that's the truth in the scripts going back to the beginning. And in a weird way, that's his danger in the movie.
Mm.
That, you know, he doesn't... scientists, whether it's Norman or you know, Connors in this movie, scientists care.
Yeah.
And I think there's a, you know, they sometimes go right or left of morality, mm-hmm. but they give a shit.
Yeah.
And I don't think Rotha does. I think Rotha's doing his job.
It's a calendar.
Yeah. And Rotha wants results for his boss.
Yeah.
And that's a very dangerous thing in life. Because he doesn't care, he's blind to consequence.
Mm.
And in some ways, he's the final piece, straw that results in Connors doing what he does. And so we wanted, that was always part of the idea, regardless of what
people
thought.
He was never supposed to be a villain. He was supposed to be...
An enabler of villains.
He's
there's always the accountant.
He's
that's right.
He's the pressure point for everybody.
Yeah.
And not intrusive one, but yet very effective in his power.
Yeah,
he pushes buttons.
To move things too fast.
That's right.
And that's exactly what happened here. I think Connors knew it was premature, but he also knew that it's now or never.
Absolutely. Well, gents, I think James and I could talk to you about this film for hours, but people are literally banging on the window telling us to stop. So Matt Tomac and Avi Arad, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much. Great being in Empire in London.
We love
finally.
Empire.
Well,
this
there you go.
So
the
cool.
feeling is mutual. So there it is.
All right.
Yeah,
it's all good.
I love it.
We'll see you in a couple of years.
Thank you.
Indeed. Cheers.
Bye.
Okay, so that's what Avi and Matt had to say. Let's turn our attention to what we have to say. Very general terms, guys. What do we think of The Amazing Spider-Man, Helen?
I had a bit of a problem with this one because I quite liked it. There were many elements that I thought were really good, but it just didn't leave me kind of fired up. I didn't come away from it sort of exhilarated. I didn't come away from it kind of bouncing. And I think this is the kind of film which, if it's done really, really well, I do come away from bouncing. You know, it's meant to be a nice, joyous summer blockbuster, and it didn't quite have that. It just wasn't successful as that for me.
Interesting. So in a way, maybe an insubstantial filling in an Avengers Dark Knight sandwich?
Yes, I think that's the problem, isn't it? Because it is coming after the Avengers, which brilliantly succeeded at doing just that, at you know, telling a story, at having characters and giving them character moments and giving them stuff to do and building those characters further up, but also, you know, giving us action and ridiculous superhero fights and effects and everything else. So I think it does have a lot to measure up to. We are obviously looking forward to The Dark Knight Rises. And for me, it didn't quite measure up. But even just on its own terms, I think it, you know, I find it hard to remember what was in it. Nothing kind of stuck out for me, apart from maybe the two leads who I thought were terrific.
That's useful for a spoiler-filled podcast.
Well, you know, I'm gonna try and do what I can.
Oh, there was a guy, and he had something. There was something come out of his hand, and there was a man in a coat. He had a tail. I can't really remember, but anyway, do go and see it.
I think Helen was drugged, clearly.
I did go see it with Chris, so it's possible.
It is true. I'll drug anyone.
That was exactly how I felt coming out. My first thought was, having seen The Avengers, which... is so huge, the scale of it is so huge, the action is so huge, but also the character stuff is brilliant. And having seen this, it didn't live up to that on any level, really. It just felt small, and the characters weren't as fun.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted you in here today, Nick, because you have a sort of diametrically opposed view in this movie than I do. In particular, you have a problem with Andrew Garfield, don't you?
I don't have a huge problem with him. I think he's a good actor, very good actor. But I just didn't buy him as Peter Parker. I'm not a huge Spider-Man fanatic. I don't, you know everything about him. But I kind of bought Tobey Maguire as Peter Parker, the nerdy, dweeby guy who gets beaten up on and then becomes a superhero. And it's really satisfying when he starts, you know, fighting back and doing heroic things. Whereas Andrew Garfield, he's tall, he's good looking, he's a skateboarding whiz. I didn't get why people were picking on him. And, you know, he was already flirting with Emma Stone. She seemed to be into him beforehand. So he was having a good time even without being bitten by a spider.
I don't think this movie necessarily went as deeply into the bullying aspect of Peter Parker. I mean, I think that was just one thing, and it just happened to be he was trying to stop a fight and got hit by Flash Thompson.
But He has to be an underdog, doesn't he? Peter Parker has to be an underdog.
He still is an underdog. Yeah, he's struggling against, you know, his he doesn't know what happened to his parents, which is a very interesting thread that this film introduces. He's clearly unhappy at home. He's unhappy at school. He's flirting with Gwen Stacy, but he hasn't, you know, he hasn't sealed the deal by any stretch of the imagination. Easy now. And I really, really liked Andrew Garfield. I always feel that he, you know, I've spoken to him a lot about this film over the last couple of years, and he's got a real connection to this character, a real connection to Peter Parker. Loved the character growing up. And interesting enough, a connection more to Peter Parker than to Spider-Man, I would say.
I actually kind of agree with you on this, Chris. I actually liked him as Peter Parker, and I don't think Peter Parker has to be a sort of stereotypical nerd in order for this to work. I mean, he was kind of quiet and withdrawn, and he, you know, I think, and awkward seeming. He did very well at the body language of being a 17-year-old.
Yeah, because he's 28 now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I didn't get that from it. I think the problem was for me more the characterization of Spider-Man, because Spider-Man in this, especially in the early scenes. Now I get that he's kind of meant to be, you know, learning about himself and becoming the Spider-Man he's meant to be, if you will. But he comes across as just insufferable. This is not my Spider-Man. This is not a hero.
You mean the wisecracking?
Not just the wisecracking, although I think that scene with the carjacker is kind of terrible that way. But he's not, you know, he doesn't seem like he's really doing good. This is not a Spider-Man who's accomplishing good in the world. And I get that he's, you know, has to make that journey and get to that point, but that journey takes up most of the film, and that's not my Spider-Man. That's not Spider-Man.
Can we just talk for a minute about the scene where he decides on the costume? He falls, he's on a roof, right?
He's on a roof running away from people who he has
falls antagonized. Into a wrestling ring.
Yes.
And that's how he decides on the costume. That is awful. That scene was awful.
It's inorganic. I may grant you that.
But the Raimi one had a really fun way of doing it, and I get that they couldn't repeat what Sam Raimi had done, you know, when he becomes a wrestler with his using his powers to try and get some cash. Yeah. Right? I thought that worked really well.
It's a fundamental problem, though, isn't it? It's how does a geeky high school kid come up with a perfectly tailored Lycra outfit? Do you know what I mean? How do you organically fix that into a story?
And Kick-Ass kind of spoofed that, didn't he?
Well, yeah, very much so, yeah. And he looks like a dork, and that's the point. But how do you get a costume that looks really good but also fit it into that storyline? I think it's always going to be clumsy.
I'd love to see in a film like this, someone getting bitten by something or have a radioactive waste or whatever it is, it turns him into a superhero. And then they just go to a Hollywood costume designer and just pay them a load of cash. Because those guys, they can kick people
Bruce
out.
Wayne has money. He goes to Lucius Fox and he's sorted.
He does.
I mean?
But Peter Parker doesn't have that. Ridiculously high tech. It looked really expensive in this film. It looked much more expensive than in the Raimi ones.
Well, in the Raimi ones, apparently.
He's a wizard with a needle and thread.
In the Raimi ones, didn't it cost like $10,000? Or was it $80,000? I heard some insane amount for the cost of the suits in the Raimi one.
Right.
And it's kind of the same thing here. That is clearly high tech.
But his first one
fabric.
Is rubbish in the Raimi one. Do you remember that he comes
up
with
absolutely.
That
and that kind of gave it an edge of believability when he came up with something slightly better.
And again, it's the same thing in this movie. The first costume he comes up with is rubbish. It's essentially, you know, not too far away from my Vidi Bloggy Sweatman costume for the very first Comic Con we did, where basically I'd cut the mask out of a Batman t-shirt and I was using a cape.
It was a comforter off the bed in the Marriott.
It was a comforter off one of the beds that we were staying
in. And we cut out a piece of paper and stuck it on your chest with an E
on it. Yeah.
It's only compared to the later high-tech Vidi Bloggy Sweatman outfits.
Which was a natural cape and a sorrel mask. So there we go. Yeah. That stuff I didn't mind so much. What do we think about the new mystery of the film? This incorporation of his parents into Peter's origin, which is something that's kind of happened in the comics over the last few years or so, where his parents have become much more important to his origin.
I never really saw the point. I'll be honest, and I didn't particularly like it in the comics. I think it kind of it piles on unbelievability. There's a point, you know, obviously we're all suspending disbelief here. We're suspending disbelief and you know, believing that this guy was bitten by a spider and developed Spider-Man powers. Fine. Ridiculous, but I'm okay with it. It's when you also pile on all these other coincidences. So his parents are also some kind of super whatevers and have been mysteriously vanished. And that's all connected to the doctor who becomes a lizard, who's connected to the shadowy businessman who may or may not become something else in future. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the doctor who becomes a lizard also employs the girl that Peter's crushing on, who's also the daughter of the chief of police. Mm-hmm. It gets to a point, it's like some of the criticisms I've heard of the Star Wars universe and the Star Wars prequels. The world is too small. All these people have not met in all these convenient ways before. It instead of making it all fit together better, it actually makes it all fall apart.
Yeah, but then Disney keeps reminding us it's a small world after all.
Yeah, but that ride will drive you insane if you go around it more than once. Have you not? Oh, goodness.
Yeah, am I right in thinking that you don't find out Peter Parker's dad was working on?
No, you don't. I think the inference, and Avi and Matt talked about it a little bit, the inference is that his dad was experimenting or has done something, has jazzed Peter's DNA up in such a way that should, in the future, something happen to him.
Like he'd get bitten by a weird modified spider.
If you or I were bitten by a genetically modified spider, we would die in the most horrible way, probably make Ebola look like a picnic. But this guy, immediately, is beating people up in the tube.
He's already got sort of four legs of the spider thing.
Yes.
Metaphorical.
Metaphorically four legs.
I wish I hadn't brought up metaphorical legs. I don't know where I'm going with that.
And he's got another metaphorical four legs now.
Right.
See, I never got that from watching the film. I mean, you see the little spider in the little glass case, so there's something spidery going on, and that's obviously the spider that bites him. Although, what are those spiders doing in that room? They're like weaving a blanket or something. You know all the spiders when he comes in and he stops it and then they all fall on him?
James, it's science.
What are they doing?
Science.
They're making a sign. It's like they're making a quilt.
They're science spiders.
They're science spiders, so they're essentially doing research.
They're looking for the Higgs boson.
Right. Okay. Excellent.
Or maybe that's where the web shooter fluid comes from. Maybe. Is that another?
Oh, no, that is where he gets it from.
That is annoying as well, because I have to say that was one of the things about the Raimi movie that, you know, people were a bit unconvinced by the time. You know, the hardcore comic fans were appalled that he would go for organic web slingers. But that was one of the things that made perfect sense to me. Why would this guy who's bitten by a spider also be the guy who magically develops the weird, you know, just have him have organic webs? It just makes, it's elegant. It's a more elegant solution. And, you know, this whole idea that maybe his parents mess with his DNA, it's just a bit the first Hulk, isn't it?
Just seems there's quite a few things in the film that seem, you're not quite sure if they've left it deliberately ambiguous. Like the whole thing with the guy who kills Uncle Ben.
Yeah.
He doesn't find him.
No.
Are they saving that for the second film, or did they just forget?
I can see where you're coming from with this one. It does feel like the movie just kind of forgets that he's doing that. But again, Avi and Matt in the interview seem to indicate that is a deliberate thing, and that he would find him in the second movie. But it's not like he's a big bad.
I don't think he should find him, and I would have actually respected them if the whole point is that deep down he's got this inner search. You know, it's an unresolved thread in his personality. That said, I think you're right. It does feel like they just forgot about it.
But
everything got carried away, and they just
Batman,
you know, dropped it.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just, we don't.
Yeah, but
I feel like we're kind of messing around here, because honestly, you know, the whole messing with your DNA, your parents messing with your DNA thing was kind of done in Hulk. The not finding your father figure's killer was done in Batman. I mean, the entire sort of lizard thing in the last act, you know, big thing in a high place in New York that's going to infect the entire local populace and turn them into the villain, was done in the original X-Men. Yeah.
Liked this film? I'm just double checking.
I'm not going to be completely negative, so
you know,
I'm going to introduce a positive.
Yes, please.
Aunt May, much less annoying in this one.
Much less.
Still
much
annoying, less annoying, but much less annoying.
Oh, this
also,
is this
Uncle
is one that,
Ben was Jed Bartlett, so you know.
Well, this is one of the film's fantastic triumphs for me. I think the casting is just far superior to the Raimi films. I prefer the action sequences in Sam's films, and I think there's a greater sense that he was wedded stylistically to the action scenes, that he understood innately what it would be like to be a spider slash man in situations like that, where you're fighting someone with eight arms and whatnot. And I think Mark Webb it almost feels like a almost perfunctory technical exercise at times with the action sequences. Mm. He's clearly much more interested in the boy meets girl stuff, which I thought was a triumph.
Yeah, it was lovely, actually. Yeah.
I thought that stuff was flawless. And to completely contradict Nick, I think Garfield embodies, as I think I've said before, Peter Parker in a way that Maguire never did. I think he really captures the essence of it. And the much maligned scene with the car thief, while it is very ham-fisted, that's Spider-Man to me. That's him. The wisecracking Spider-Man is what makes him and characters like Deadpool so enjoyable in the comics.
Yeah, but he's not really so much wisecracking there as just being irritated. I don't know.
But that's the character.
No,
Spider-Man is a little bit irritating.
No,
he irritates
like
the other
Spider-Man
characters
but
in
but
the
he
in
is
the
funny.
Books.
I mean, this is
he
one
is
of the
funny.
Things I was...
But the small knife gag, I actually think, is quite funny. It's my weakness, small knives. I think that's funny. I think
that
that's very
one
Spider-Man.
Gag, okay, yes. I quite like that one gag. I don't
but
know. Just that
yes, pretending to
scene.
Sneeze web fluid on him isn't funny. I'll grant
it's
you
not
that.
As if he's doing a stand-up gig. while he's a thousand feet up in New York. He should do, but I feel the quality of the writing of The Wisecracks just wasn't quite there. And it kind of, again, is something I get that falls by the wayside as the movie progresses. He's not really wisecracking that much with the lizard. Although, I think he has a funny line in the fight during the school, which, again, feels a bit like the 2008 Incredible Hulk. There's a fight at the university in that one, but it also leads to the greatest Stan Lee cameo, I think.
Yes.
In the history of
that
all
was one
movies.
Of the best shots in
that
the
was
film.
That was gorgeous. That was really good.
It was fantastic, and so best Stan Lee cameo.
Yep, absolutely.
I'm very over Stan Lee.
I'm not a total naysayer. I just, you know, I
you're not
issues.
You liked this film. I remember you coming out of the screen, and we both liked it, and we were both talking about what we liked a lot. It just sounds like you've suddenly gone very down on it now.
No, not at all. I came out thinking it was a 3, and I continue to think it's a 3, but I just feel like the potential was there, especially with the casting and given all of that, for it to be much more than that. I mean, you know, it could have been just plussed a little bit, to use Pixar terminology for a moment, for no reason.
I think there was a lot of skepticism, even when it was, you know, in the run-up to this coming out, that this was a kind of soulless corporate thing, that they were just making it because they had to, and they had to reintroduce this character. And I don't think that's really, you know, I don't feel like there was a burning story that they had to tell with this. It just seems...
No, but I think that's exactly what it is. It has heart. I think more than anything else, this is a film with heart. You know, it has a great, great central sort of emotional premise to it. I think where it falls down on is the action. And unfortunately, that's why a lot of people go and see comic movies, is for the great action sequences. But equally... And maybe I'm the only one, I've got a little bit of comic book movie climax fatigue. Do you know? Where you just get weary of the CGI characters fighting each other at the end. Like the lizard and Spider-Man, I really just could have been staring around the cinema and ignoring it. And I got a bit that way at the end of The Avengers as well, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, but, you know...
Maybe I'm
that's
on my
wrong.
Own.
Yeah, you're totally on your own.
Just went on a bit long.
At least that had Tom Hiddleston.
It did. And, you know, the puny god thing makes up for an awful lot.
I thought there were a lot of great beats at the in the last... Hang on. 45 minutes of The Avengers. I know there was a lot of fun stuff going on there, and it wasn't as soulless as Transformers. But anyway, we've talked Avengers plenty in the podcast. We're here to talk Spider-Man. So,
who was it at the end? There we go. That's my question.
In the very, very last scene.
The post-credit scene, who is that?
Well, my initial reaction would have been Norman Osborn, but I think it's a little bit too obvious.
Yeah, and also, you know, Avi and Matt were a bit... They seemed to, well, I wouldn't say who it was, they seemed to indicate that that wasn't the case.
Any theories, Helen, on who that could have been?
I had assumed it was Norman Osborn, to be honest, and I thought that was one thing that I thought was quite elegant, because if some variation on the lizard formula made him into Green Goblin, that would seem to me to be a very logical and very elegant way of continuing the story onwards, because it still links back to that formula that Peter gave to Kurt Connors. You know, it would keep those characters kind of moving forward together. It would keep that kind of link there, which seemed like a good idea to me. So I kind of hope it was Norman Osborn, to be perfectly honest.
Well, interesting.
I don't know this universe that well, but are there other big villains that we haven't seen yet? Because we've seen a lot of goblins, hobgoblins and green goblins. I'm a bit over the goblin. If it does turn out to just be Green Goblin coming back, I feel like I've seen that.
Well, I think they're clearly building towards it, but I thought it was very interesting what they did with Norman Osborn in this film, not showing him at all. I was convinced that the last scene would be big name cameo shows up and I am Norman Osborn for the second film, cackling away. But it's interesting that he there are frequent references to him dying in this movie, so I'm not so sure that was him. I think we're going to see him in the second film. He's going to be frail. He's going to be I get the black lung pop, and he's going to reach for like the file of,
and he's going to launch
liquid.
A space mission to find the origin.
He'll be
of
played
life.
By God. Guy Pearce in old age makeup.
That'd be amazing. So he's in the black goo and Prometheus as Venom.
Suddenly everything is clear.
Oh.
I understand the whole film now.
We've solved the summer. Bye everyone. Thanks for listening.
I was disappointed not to see more lizard SWAT team action, because I enjoyed that. That was my favourite bit. A SWAT team got turned into lizards.
And then
you don't see them again until about 15 minutes on, when you see them turn into humans again. I'm like, what have they been doing for that 15 minutes? I want to see that 15 minutes.
SWATing stuff, presumably. But
awesome. Reptilian SWAT team stuff.
I'd love to see them fighting C. Thomas Howell. Just on his own. Well, he swipes him with his crane. He just swings his crane at them, and they're trying to shoot him with their lizard guns.
That would have been amazing.
That would have been fantastic. What do we make of the lizard's plan? And indeed, the lizard as a whole.
How did he get his stuff into the sewer? With one arm.
That's the plot hole.
I'm sorry, I tend to dwell on this
stuff. Man in a van, surely.
Why did he become such an implacable hater of Spider-Man?
Drugs, Helen. Don't do drugs.
It's the same thing Octopus does it in Doc Ock in Spider-Man 2.
He has a kind of reason. He thinks that Spider-Man has in some way been involved in the death of his wife. There's some kind of thing there. All Spider-Man did is save some people who the lizard wasn't targeting anyway. So why does he suddenly hate him?
I think we have to understand he's completely insane.
There's insane and then there's I don't know. I just, you know, it was a thing that occurred to me. Why that?
Some of the Spider-Man lizard scenes I really, really liked. The scene in the university I thought was fantastic. And as we said in the podcast last week, the scene in the sewer where Spidey spreads his webs and kind of, you know, has to try and detect where the lizard's coming from. Was that Rare Beast in a movie like this? It was
on a camera.
Well, yes, but he's a genius, but he's still also a 17-year-old.
But just to go back to what Helen said, I think possibly, is it not that the lizard sees him as a kind of threat because he's the one who's essentially solved the mystery of the formula, and he clearly doesn't approve of it, or maybe the lizard thinks
he's
the one.
How does he know that Peter Parker is Spider-Man at that point?
Well, because shut up.
Okay.
But at that point, he's only fought Spider-Man once. In fact, he hasn't fought him at all, has he?
Not really.
There was that sequence in on the bridge where they don't really encounter each other. And then I think that's the second time they meet. That's the first time the lizard and Spider-Man meet, which follows that scene that with the weird, freaky lizard mouse thing.
What happened to that?
In Connor's... maybe that's what walks into the room at the end of the movie. It's become human.
I've got an observation about the bridge scene. A giant lizard creature takes over a bridge and starts throwing cars off it. Spider-Man comes along and saves the day. The news report the next day is Spider-Man turns vigilante.
Yeah, what's up?
There's
with that?
Nothing about the lizard.
What?
So what you're saying, this film is about bad journalism.
It is, yep.
Yeah.
That's clearly setting up J. Jonah Jameson and then Daily Bugle for the second time around. But yeah, so we're not big fans of the lizard's plan, which is to turn everyone into New York into lizards. And then go from there where? I'm not quite sure, but
it's even stupider than Magneto's plan, I would say.
It is stupider than Magneto. It's similar to Magneto's plan.
But Magneto had thought
it out a little bit better. It was a political statement. This one is just silly.
His was, we're all a minority now. Ha ha.
Indeed.
And the lizard is, we're all... It's not easy being green.
Going back to the scene at the end, any other theories for who it might be, James? Is it a Mysterio? Because he gets in and out without seeming to open the door, this guy, whoever it is. He seems to be able to...
Yeah, but doors do that nowadays. Even Tesco have them.
That was me doing a door open.
I don't actually... it's like I said to them, I was wondering whether or not this was like the Thanos thing in the Avengers where fanboys are supposed to see it and go, ah, ha, 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 I know who that is. And I don't think it is. I think it was almost a, there's more to this, who, you know, it could be anyone. I wonder if they even know who they think it is. Maybe it's just there. Maybe it's a bit of foreshadowing and it doesn't actually...
So the idea is that it's a bigger conspiracy that people have been involved, that Peter's parents have disappeared mysteriously. Because again, that's something I thought the film was going to tie up, that Kurt Connors was going to be involved implicitly in the death of Peter's parents.
Clearly there was something there.
But he's not, from what I understand. He kind of knows something, but wasn't the guy who crashed a plane or did whatever it was.
If there's a curse on this summer, surely it's setting up the sequel.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think this is a movie that can get away with it. I think this is a movie that knows it's got a sequel coming.
No, but I know what Snow White and the Huntsman,
Prometheus, this, it's just... too much, you know. Tell a story,
just finish the story,
finish the story, and then, you know.
But even the Raimi Spider-Man does that as well. The Raimi Spider-Man with Harry Osborn, you know, sets him up at the end when, you know, he finds his father's lair. And
there's a way of doing it that feels satisfying, and there's a way of doing it that doesn't. And I think you can leave a certain amount, you know, kind of hanging if you've told your main story. Your main story in that one was sort of, you know, the whole fight against the Green Goblin. Harry was, you know, kind of a bystander to some extent. So you can leave the bystander with something to do for next time. I just feel like the main people in the plot, their story should be done.
But what I really liked about this film, and I think this is a film that has a luxury of playing the long game. It knows, and, you know, I think the box office tracking is on course for something like $125, $130 million opening weekend in the States. So
That's a six-day opening weekend, though, let's be clear.
But it's going to have a sequel. It's going to have a threequel. It knows this, so it can afford to take its time with some plot elements. For example, I was pleasantly surprised and impressed that they didn't kill Gwen Stacy this time around, because I think we all know it's probably coming at some point in the next movie, or maybe the movie after that. Because historically in the comics, you know, if you're listening to this, you're a Spider-Man fan, I'm assuming, so you would know that historically in the comics, she gets killed at the hands of the Green Goblin.
I did not know that.
So, oh, there you go.
Here is a slight problem with that in movie terms. Emma Stone, and especially Emma Stone alongside Andrew Garfield, is as adorable as a basket full of puppies. And as we all know,
you can't
from
kill puppies.
you can't kill puppies. You know, I mean, what was it? The Great Waldo Pepper, Susan Sarandon dying. When she fell from Robert Redford's arms in the opening scene of the movie, the audience did not forgive that, and they never got them back for that movie, and that movie flopped. If you kill someone that the audience really loves, you're in trouble. And the only way you could get away with it, I think, in this current incarnation of Spider-Man with this cast, is if you have someone more adorable than Emma Stone waiting in the wings.
There is no such thing.
A basket of puppies.
And there is no such
could
thing.
Play
exactly. Unless you have two baskets of puppies or a non-existent actress who is more adorable than Emma Stone,
unless
you're going to be in serious
danger. Emma Stone turns her hair back red and plays MJ as well.
And just pretends like nothing happened.
Yeah.
Like Sunset Beach, where
absolutely.
They would just go, the part of Joseph will not be played by
We've just solved the problem.
Yeah. I would be done with that. Okay, carry on.
Yeah, the part of Mary Jane will not be played by Emma Stone. That would be amazing. But I think that, you know, this movie is that horrible word, darker, but it does have a darker take on Spider-Man than certainly the first Raimi film did. And the death of Uncle Ben, for example, was much more emotionally raw than the Raimi version. Maybe that's partially because we like Martin Sheen as an actor more than we like or liked Cliff Robertson, who knows. But I think Peter Parker as well, there's this feeling from people I don't think who know in the comics necessarily that Spider-Man is a very light, funny, saney character. A lot of it obviously comes from the fact that he's very quippy and quite witty, but that character is actually mired in misery. Everyone around him at some point dies or horrible things happen to them, and it's all about this: with great power comes great responsibility, and you have to protect your secret identity. And I think they're going to go down this route with Gwen Stacy at some point. And I won't be watching when it happens. I'm going to turn my head away from the cinema. If Green Goblin comes in the second one, and I'm just going to say to Emma Stone, don't go up any high buildings, don't do anything, don't go anywhere, lock yourself in and just let the whole thing blow
it won't make a difference. It'd be like Final Destination. Death will find her.
Yeah, she'll probably choke on a peanut.
I mean, do you think they will re-tackle the Venom thing? Because I think for a lot of Spider-Man fans, me included, Venom is the villain.
Well, they're still talking about this spin-off, aren't they? This Venom spin-off which Josh Trank has been attached to.
And this is a Sony thing as well?
I believe it is.
Okay.
I believe it is.
So they're unlikely to...
I'd be surprised if Fox owned it. And it certainly hasn't resorted back to Marvel. Referred it back to Marvel, sorry. I think Avi Arad, if you pushed him on it, he would admit that they didn't quite get Venom right.
That would be the understatement of the decade.
Wasn't it Avi Arad's idea? It was him that wanted to. Raimi wasn't that keen.
No, but it was fine. I think to tackle Venom was a great idea. To tackle Venom and to tackle the Goblin and to tackle Sandman and to chuck them all into a big mix and not do decent service.
But not knowing much about the character of Venom, what did they get wrong about it?
To be honest, the origin, the whole, it was so throwaway, that whole,
it's
the
such
symbiote
a big
just
character
appears
for
off this meteor, and it's just, it didn't feel good. Total Grace was wrong for it. I mean, there was so much wrong with that. I mean, Eddie Brock is a bodybuilder. He's huge.
The perfect Eddie Brock for me, the perfect Venom for me, maybe slightly old now, but would be Kurt Russell. I think he'd be a great Eddie Brock.
Even so, I think you want someone really sort of like physically intimidating in a way.
Tom Cruise,
Kurt Russell, yes, much like Tom Cruise as Jack Reacher. I think you want someone who has that sort of raw size, because the point with Venom is that he dwarfs Spider-Man. He's colossal, and I think you need that from the actor as well as, I mean, the suit bulks him up anyway, but you need that from the actor himself.
Yeah, fair enough. But this movie definitely just dwelled on the Lizard. There were no secondary villains, which I was happy to see.
Yep. Too many villains spoil the broth.
Absolutely. I mean, there are instances, obviously, where it works. Batman Begins, for example. Dark Knight, for another example. Helen's sneering. Why are you sneering at Chris Nolan? You know that's a sacrilege.
I'm not really. I think actually Dark Knight did do it well. It can be done well, but I think you have to be incredibly disciplined in your storytelling to make it work. I mean, you've got to give everybody enough time to make it clear what they're doing. And even the Sacred Dark Knight, you know, when you actually start examining it, the plot completely falls to pieces. But it's just, as it goes, you don't care, because it's really well paced. You know, the action's obviously terrific, the acting is obviously terrific.
But it's not a multiple villain film, it's a single villain film, which then evolves into the fall of one of the heroes. You know what I mean? It's not It's not the same thing.
Absolutely. There's something else interesting about this film. That Gwen Stacy knows Spider-Man's secret identity.
Yeah, which is nice.
She knows that Peter Parker is Spider-Man from quite early on in the film.
Bug Boy.
In what I thought was the film's cheekiest sequence, that sort of seduction scene on the balcony, which starts, metaphor fans, with Peter Parker spraying Gwen Stacy's butt with a sticky substance, pulling her towards him. They then embrace, have a passionate kiss, and her last words in that scene are, and I'm not kidding, I'm coming. So, subtext fans, please write in with what you think that could mean. We'll talk about it in next week's podcast.
Do not bring your filth to a lovely, heartwarming romance.
But in that scene, it's a really, really nice way of it's almost as good as that great scene in Superman 2 where, you know, Lois Lane throws his specs into the fire and he picks him up and, I'm not hurt. I'm Superman. I forgot to tell you. So it opens up an endless world of possibilities for the second film, doesn't it?
Do you think the lizard might come back?
He might be. He's on ice, so to speak. And interesting enough, because the Raimi films had a habit of killing their bad guys. You know, they killed the Green Goblin, they killed Harry at the end of Spider-Man 3, and they killed Doc Ock. Sandman gets away with it, doesn't he?
He does.
This would involve me watching Spider-Man 3 again. So
yes, don't do that. No, he does, I believe. But then he's quite sympathetic in his own way.
And Venom dies as well. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. He's kind of like a good.
Yeah, he's a good baddie.
Yeah. So I don't know, maybe the lizard will come back into it. Why do you think he's going to have?
I don't know. I just always think it's interesting when they leave them alive because, you know, they could have killed him very easily. Mm. Put him in prison instead. I guess you wouldn't have had that last scene if you'd killed him.
Yeah.
I don't particularly want to see him come back, but I'm just curious whether he was okay. Well, I just don't like villains that are just lumps of CG. I like, I think the best Spider-Man villain's been Alfred Molina is Doc Ock. I thought he was absolutely brilliant. Yeah. That's one of my favourite superhero films.
I thought
because it's a guy with some CG stuff going on, but
yeah,
you know.
But I thought as villains in movies like this go, the CG was pretty good.
It was inoffensive.
I think for me it was more the design. I didn't love how the lizard looked. And I'm not sure that I have a particularly strong image in mind of how the lizard should look. He's not one of the villains.
He looked like a baby Godzilla from the 1998.
Well, the other thing that he's been compared to, which I have to confess I have a little bit of sympathy for, is the villains in the Super Mario Brothers movie. Because he has that same kind of quite flat, yet lizard-like face.
That's true, actually,
which
that's
is true. Not the kind of comparison you want to be, you know, provoking.
Interesting. For me, the lizard I've always pictured in my mind throughout the years was the lizard of the Secret Wars, the Marvel limited edition. So very much lab coat, big lizardy snout, massive tail.
This purple was trousers,
a different variation. Yeah, he has trousers like the Hulk. He's not running around lizard tackle out. But I guess he kind of is in this film. Maybe that's why it's...
Because he has a lab coat in that one sequence, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, And he talks in this one as well, which was interesting. I thought the Spider-Man lizard stuff was fine, but I think, like we said before, if you feel that Mark Webb wasn't necessarily invested in it, then you yourself kind of tune out a little bit. For example, and we talked about this with Matt and Avi, the last shot of the movie, I think we're all pretty much agreed that it would have been really nice if the movie had the balls to end on that lovely last shot of Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone, her smile as she realizes that Peter Parker's last words to her are, you know, indicate that there's a future for them, despite the fact that, you know, her dad has just been horribly killed.
And that's a wonderful sequence, and it is genuinely emotional. I've, you know, felt all warm and fuzzy inside.
Yeah.
But I think that
you want to see these kids together.
That speaks to what we like about the film. The heart of that film was the relationship, and I'm just not sure that either the producers or Webb really understand that was the best part of the film. The fact that you get bad Spider-Man, I understand what Abby was saying, you want to see Spider-Man, but I'm not sure you do. This was, for me, a film about Peter Parker, not a film about Spider-Man, and I would have been happy seeing it end with Peter Parker.
And it ends on that kind of POV shot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the one
it ends on the classic spider pose, isn't it? The sort of slow-mo pose of him.
It ends on a sequence that we've seen before, essentially at least two times in the Raimi films, where he's swinging through the streets. Yeah. And it's good effects. I mean, the Spider-Man CG in this movie is way beyond anything
so
it was in the
better.
Previous three films. And I, from what I understand, it cost less as well. So what the hell were they doing for the first three films?
Financial crisis.
Perhaps, yeah. I just think, for example, last year's, I know Captain America got flack in some quarters for ending the way it did, but I thought the last line, Chris Evans' last line,
But I had a date,
was just perfect. Absolute beautiful ending, bittersweet, real tang of tragedy to that man's story, and the movie had the balls to just go, that's it, that's the end of the film. And even Thor ends with the two lovers separated and has that lovely bit where Idris Elba goes, oh, she's looking for you, and then it just has the courage to end on a half smile. Doesn't have, not a bit where Thor swings his hammer and flies at the camera or conjures up a lightning and then flies up at the sky and it goes directed by Kenneth Branagh. It doesn't do that. It just ends really, really nicely and beautifully, and I think Marvel are really, really good at ending their films in a very memorable way.
I think all movies should end with shawarma.
They should end up with shawarma. Spider-Man, spider shawarma.
Yeah, just different superheroes eating shawarma.
That would have been amazing. But yeah, it's just, and I understand, having had Avi and Matt in here, I understand their feelings about ending with Spider-Man. But when it cut to that sequence, I was like, really? Oh, come on. You were so close.
It was perfect and you ruined
so
it.
So close. Maybe not that bad. But I would have bounded out the cinema had it ended on that shot. And as it was, I was like, oh, it's good.
I think we haven't asked the really important question here that yes, no one has yet come up with a convincing explanation for.
Oh, right.
Oh, no, that, thank you.
Oh, okay. The other question.
The other question, how did Andrew Garfield's hair stay so bouffant under the Spider-Man hood?
It was amazing, wasn't it?
It was incredible.
It's like he just stepped out of a salon.
No, he was great. I think he was fine.
Listen, I didn't come out raging that he was terrible. I think he's a great actor. Mm-hmm. I've liked him in everything. He's really likeable. I just didn't quite root for him in the kind of way that I felt like I should be rooting for him. That's all. So I just thought maybe with a different performance, it might have worked better for me. But he's fine.
No, I thought he was
fantastic. And she was great.
He was, so at times he was shuddering with raw emotion. Where Uncle Ben gets killed, it was just, you could see the hurt and the pain in his eyes and the guilt. And then later on, you could see, you know, I know that they may be together in real life, but you can really see the chemistry between Garfield and Emma Stone, and just where this burgeoning love affair comes from. And it's really, really nice to watch.
Yeah,
and you can see as well, I mean, you know, his body language as Spider-Man is different from the Tobey Maguire body language. You know, he's really trying to work on getting spidery movements in there and making him feel like he's an alien in his own skin. And I think there's a lot of potential. I mean, but again, as long as we said to Avi and Matt, he doesn't get a lot of road miles between this and the sequel, you know, because he's touching 30 now. Imagine he's got massive bags under his eyes and huge lines in his skin.
Look much like us.
Spider-Man. Yeah, exactly like us, precisely. Anything else to talk about? Happy enough?
I just feel sorry for the chap who was meant to play the lizard. Who was the guy? What's the name of the actor who was in the Raimi?
Dylan Baker.
Yeah. Do you think he'll go see this?
Probably not. So, Nick, as you said, they were building towards the lizard as the villain for Spider-Man 4. Poor old Dylan Baker didn't quite get there, but they did it anyway. Do you think, I mean, there's a school of thought, and I put this to Tolmach and Avi Arad for the Spider-Man feature in Empire. Could they have just carried on Bond style and done Spider-Man 4 with Andrew Garfield and parachuted in Emma Stone, as she would have been perfectly acceptable as Mary Jane Watson? She'd be perfectly acceptable as anything.
Yes.
No, says James. Definitively.
Yes. And I think predominantly because what they did with this is exactly what I wanted them to do. Peter Parker becoming Spider-Man is the interesting story, and Sam Raimi glossed over that. He shot straight past it and he didn't see an awful lot to it, and that's the story that I wanted to hear, and this is the story that got told here. It may not have been told exactly how I would have liked it to have been told, but you know, that was the core of it.
I totally disagree with that. I think what's really interesting is Peter Parker being Spider-Man, because I've always loved the fact that it doesn't solve all his problems. It just gives him a whole new set of were things to worry about. And you know, I know that Sam Raimi already did cover that. You know, he kept having money problems, he kept having problems at school, and you know, you would have had to find some way of doing that in a fresh way. I admit that, but at the same time, I just think that's what's really interesting. Spider-Man's always combined being a superhero with also being a real person and also having real person worries in a way that very few of his contemporaries have to the same extent. And I really like that, so I would have liked to have seen him just keep carrying on.
Yeah, I'm kind of bored of origin stories. Why not just start a franchise in the middle? We'll just put some new actors in it and you know, take it, come up with some new stories.
Well, that's what I felt this film did. I felt it got the cursory stuff out of the way, with the exception of Uncle Ben, which it actually infested some real emotion in. The kind of, you know, the spider bite, that was dealt with very cursorily and very perfunctorily, and I feel that it wasn't interested in other stuff. It was interested in his relationship with his parents. It was interested in a different dynamic with Aunt May. And obviously there was no JJJ. There was no Daily Bugle. There was no Norman Osborn. It did feel different to me, and different enough from the Raimi films to justify it. But I still, could they have done a Spider-Man 4? I'd kind of almost like to see a studio do that again, like James Bond, just go, yeah, it's the same story but with a different actor. When was the last time that really happened?
I think Superman everyone. Returns maybe
Superman Returns true. Yeah, I That's guess true.
I think everyone has seen Spider-Man. The last one was 5 years ago. Everyone's seen these films. Everyone knows the character. It's on
but you've
TV
also,
all the
you've
time.
Covered so much ground. I mean, you've done The Goblin, you've done Sandman, you've ruined Venom. Do you know what I mean? You've gone through so much stuff. I think you've burnt too many
miles.
There's
got to be more than that. This has to be. I mean, there was talk of Larry David being the Vulture, which was probably utter nonsense. But I did see a great Photoshop picture of it. And I
when you're scrabbling around for like Mysterio and stuff like that, I think you've got problems.
There's
got
to be more than that.
There are great films. There are. I mean, there's I've always liked Electro, who was one of the bad guys in James Cameron's treatment. I don't think they got Sandman right. Who else is there? There's Rhino, Scorpion. I mean, he has this long litany of animal-based bad guys.
Craven the Hunter.
They're not the
marmots.
Craven's a good one, actually. Craven that's something good that one, I'd like to see. And people like Black Cat.
They can create a new one, though, can't they? They've got carte blanche. Come up with a new villain for Spider-Man. Why not?
Jellyfish Man.
Gecko Man. No, that's too close to Lizard. Wombat Guy. I don't know.
Salamander but, Boy.
Yeah. I mean, I would have loved to have seen Raimi, what he was, he must have been thinking about the Lizard. He had the character in all three of his films. He must have had some kind of vision for what he was going to do with it. And I kind of can't help thinking that Raimi, he loves monsters and he did such a great job with Doc Ock. What would his Lizard have been like? I'd love to kind of find out what he was thinking of.
Less Welsh, perhaps.
The ideal would have been if they could have had the whole Spider-Man parasite thing in Spider-Man 3, set all of it up to create Venom at the end, and you could have had Spider-Man facing off against Green Goblin 2/Sandman, and at the same time Eddie Brock's becoming Venom, and you just set that up. That is the kind of setup for a sequel I actually would have been okay with. True, and you wouldn't have ruined Venom, and we all could still be around, and that would be happy.
But Spider-Man 3 is a classic sequel. It just slightly gets out of control, doesn't it, really? And it's
too much dancing.
Too much. I quite
like
it.
I like
the dancing's okay. It's much maligned.
The dancing stuff's a bit like the weird diversion into bad Superman in Superman 3, where you kind of get a feeling that maybe
James is shaking his head.
It's the worst thing in the world.
What the dancing or
the
Superman 3?
No, not Superman 3 isn't great.
Clark Kent versus bad Clark Kent in the tire scrapyard is just amazing.
That is better than Spider-Man 3. I will absolutely agree with that.
On that bombshell, I think we've pretty much talked about everything we can possibly talk about The Amazing Spider-Man. So thanks for listening. And this goodbye to Nick.
Spider-bye.
Goodbye to James.
Goodbye.
Goodbye to Helen.
Fare thee well.
And goodbye from me. Goodbye.